Good evening. Welcome to the Just Sleep podcast. I'm Tayshia, your host. Every week, I will read you an old story to help you relax, put the stressful day behind you, and drift off to sleep. Occasionally, we will run ads in order to cover the costs of the production of the podcast. Rest assured, there will be no ads during or after the story. If you prefer an ad-free and intro-free show, you can join Just Sleep Premium. Visit justsleeppodcast.com/support for more information.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Tonight, I continue the story, The Princess and the Goblin. So lie down, close your eyes, and let me read you a story. Chapter 19, Goblin Councils. He must have slept a long time, for when he awoke, he felt wonderfully restored, indeed almost well, and very hungry. There were voices in the outer cave. Once more, then, it was night, for the goblins slept during the day and went about their affairs during the night. In the universal and constant darkness of their dwelling, they had no reason to prefer the one arrangement to the other, but from aversion to the sun people, they chose to be busy when there was least chance of their being met either by the miners below, when they were burrowing, or by the people of the mountain above, when they were feeding their sheep or catching their goats. And indeed, it was only when the sun was away that the outside of the mountain was sufficiently like their own dismal regions to be endurable to their mole eyes, so thoroughly had they become unaccustomed to any light beyond that of their own fires and torches. Curdie listened, and soon found that they were talking of himself. "How long will it take?" asked Harelip. "Not many days, I should think," answered the king. "They are poor, feeble creatures, those sun people. and want to be always eating. We can go a week at a time without food and be all the better for it. But I've been told they eat 2 or 3 times every day. Can you believe it? They must be quite hollow inside. Not at all like us, 9/10 of whose bulk is solid flesh and bone. Yes, I judge a week of starvation will do for him. If I may be allowed a word, interposed the Queen, I think I ought to have some voice in the matter. The wretch is entirely at your disposal, my spouse, interrupted the King. He is your property. You caught him yourself. We should never have done it. The Queen laughed. She seemed in far better humour than the night before. I was about to say, she resumed, that it does seem a pity to waste such fresh meat. What are you thinking of, my love? Said the King. The very notion of starving him implies that we are not going to give him any meat, either salt or fresh. I'm not such a stupid as that comes to, returned Her Majesty. What I mean is that, by the time he is starved, there will hardly be a picking upon his bones. The King gave a great laugh. Well, my spouse, you may have him when you like, he said. I don't fancy him for my part. I'm pretty sure he is tough eating. That would be to honour instead of punish his insolence, returned the Queen. But why should our poor creatures be deprived of so much nourishment? Our little dogs and cats and pigs and small bears would enjoy him very much. You are the best of housekeepers, my lovely Queen, said her husband. Let it be so by all means. Let us have our people in and get him out and kill him at once. He deserves it. The mischief he might have brought upon us, now that he had penetrated so far as our most retired citadel, is incalculable. Or rather, let us tie him hand and foot and have the pleasure of seeing him torn to pieces by full torchlight in the great hall. Better and better, cried the Queen and the Prince together, both of them clapping their hands. And the Prince made an ugly noise with his hare lip, just as if he had intended to be the one at the feast. But, added the Queen, bethinking herself, he is so troublesome. For poor creatures as they are, there is something about those sun people that is very troublesome. I can't imagine how it is that with such superior strength and skill and understanding as ours, we permit them to exist at all. Why do we not destroy them entirely and use their cattle and grazing lads at our pleasure? Of course, we don't want to live in their horrid country. It is far too glaring for our quieter and more refined tastes. But we might use this as a sort of outhouse, you know. Even our creatures' eyes might get used to it. And if they did grow blind, that would be of no consequence, provided that they grew fat as well. But we might even keep their great cows and other creatures, and then we should have a few more luxuries such as cream and cheese, which at present we only taste occasionally, when our brave men have succeeded in carrying some off from their farms. It is worth thinking of, said the King, and I don't know why you should be the first to suggest it, except that you have a positive genius for conquest. But still, as you say, there is something very troublesome about them, and it would be better, as I understand you to suggest, that we should starve him for a day or two first, so that he may be a little less frisky when we take him out. Once there was a goblin living in a hole. Busy he was cobblin', a shoe without a sole. By came a birdie, goblin, what do you do? Cobble at a sturdy, upper leather shoe. What's the good of that, sir? Said the little bird. Why, it's very pat, sir, plain without a word. Where 'tis all a hole, sir, never can be holes. Why should their shoes have soles, sir, when they've got no souls? What's that horrible noise? Cried the Queen, shuddering from pot metal head to granite shoes. I declare, said the King, it's the sun creature in the hole. Stop that disgusting noise, cried the Crown Prince valiantly, getting up and standing in front of the heap of stones with his face towards Curdie's prison. Do now, or I'll break your head. Break away, shouted Curdie, and began singing again. Once there was a goblin living in a hole. I really cannot bear it, said the Queen, if I could only get at his horrid toes with my slippers again. I think we had better go to bed, said the King. It's not time to go to bed, said the Queen. I would if I was you, said Curdie. Impertinent wretch, said the Queen, with the utmost scorn in her voice. An impossible if, said His Majesty with dignity. Quite, returned Curdie, and began singing again. Go to bed, goblin, do. Help the Queen take off her shoe. If you do, it will disclose a horrid set of sprouting toes. What a lie, roared the Queen in a rage. By the way, that reminds me, said the King, that for as long as we have been married, I've never seen your feet, Queen. I think you might take your shoes off when you go to bed. They positively hurt me sometimes. I will do as I like, retorted the Queen sulkily. You ought to do as your own hubby wishes you, said the King. I will not, said the Queen. Then I insist upon it, said the King. Apparently, His Majesty approached the Queen for the purpose of following the advice given by Curdie, for the latter heard a scuffle, and then a great roar from the King. Will you be quiet, then? Said the Queen, wickedly. Yes, yes, Queen, I only meant to coax you. Hands off, cried the Queen triumphantly. I'm going to bed. You may come when you like, but as long as I'm Queen, I will sleep in my shoes. It is my royal privilege. Harelip, go to bed. I'm going, said Harelip, sleepily. So am I, said the King. Come along then, said the Queen, and mind you're good, or I'll... Oh, no, no, screamed the King, in the most supplicating of tones. Curdie heard only a muttered reply in the distance, and then the cave was quite still. They had left the fire burning, and the light came through brighter than ever. Curdie thought it was time to try again if anything could be done. But he found he could not get even a finger through the crack between the slab and the rock. He gave a great rush with his shoulder against the slab. But it yielded no more than if it had been part of the rock. All he could do was to sit down and think again. By and by, he came to the resolution to pretend to be dying, in the hope they might take him out before his strength was too much exhausted to let him have a chance. Then, for the creatures, if he could but find his axe again, he would have no fear of them. And if it were not for the Queen's horrid shoes, he would have no fear at all. Meanwhile, until they should come again at night, there was nothing for him to do but forge new rhymes, now his only weapons. He had no intention of using them at present, of course, but it was well to have a stock, for he might live to want them, and the manufacture of them would help to while away the time. Chapter 20. Irene's Clue. That same morning, early, the princess woke in a terrible fright. There was a hideous noise in her room, creatures snarling and hissing and rocketing about as if they were fighting. The moment she came to herself, she remembered something she had never thought of again, what her grandmother told her to do when she was frightened. She immediately took off her ring and put it under her pillow. As she did so, she fancied she felt a finger and thumb take it gently from under her palm. It must be my grandmother, she said to herself. And the thought gave her such courage that she stopped to put on her dainty little slippers before running from the room. While doing this, she caught sight of a long cloak of sky blue thrown over the back of a chair by the bedside. She had never seen it before, but it was evidently waiting for her. She put it on, and then, feeling with the forefinger of her right hand, soon found her grandmother's thread, which she proceeded at once to follow, expecting it would lead her straight up the old stair. When she reached the door, she found it went down and ran along the floor, so that she almost had to crawl in order to keep a hold of it. Then, to her surprise and somewhat to her dismay, she found that instead of leading her towards the stair, it turned in quite the opposite direction. It led her through certain narrow passages towards the kitchen, turning aside ere she reached it, and guiding her to a door which communicated with a small backyard. Some of the maids were already up, and this door was standing open. Across the yard, the thread still ran along the ground until it brought her to a door in the wall which opened upon the mountainside. When she had passed through, the thread rose to about half her height, and she could hold it with ease as she walked. It led her straight up the mountain, The cause of her alarm was less frightful than she supposed. The cook's great black cat, pursued by the housekeeper's terrier, had bounced against her bedroom door, which had not been properly fastened, and the two had burst into the room together and commenced a battle royale. How the nurse came to sleep through it was a mystery, but I suspect the old lady had something to do with it. It was a clear, warm morning. The wind blew deliciously over the mountainside. Here and there she saw a late primrose, but she did not stop to call upon them. The sky was mottled with small clouds. The sun was not yet up, but some of their fluffy edges had caught his light and hung out orange and gold-colored fringes upon the air. The dew lay in round drops upon the leaves and hung like tiny diamond earrings from the blades of grass about her path. How lovely that bit of gossamer is, thought the princess, looking at a long undulating line that shone at some distance from her up the hill. It was not the time for gossamers, though, and Irene soon discovered that it was her own thread she saw shining on before her in the light of the morning. It was leading her, she knew not whither, but she had never in her life been out before sunrise, and everything was so fresh and cool and lively and full of something coming that she felt too happy to be afraid of anything. After leading her up a good distance, the thread turned to the left and down the path upon which she and Lutie had met Curdy. But she never thought of that, for now in the morning light, with its far outlook over the country, no path could have been more open and airy and cheerful. She could see the road, almost to the horizon, along which she had so often watched her King Papa and his troop come shining, with a bugle blast cleaving the air before them, and it was like a companion to her. Down and down the path went, then up, and then down, and then up again, getting rugged and more rugged as it went. And still, along the path went the silvery thread. And still, along the thread, went Irene's little rosy-tipped forefinger. By and by she came to a little stream that jabbered and prattled down the hill, and up the side of the stream went both path and thread. And still the path grew rougher and steeper, and the mountain grew wilder, till Irene began to think she was going a very long way from home. And when she turned to look back, she saw that the level country had vanished, and the rough bare mountain had closed in about her. But still, on went the thread, and on went the princess. Everything around her was getting brighter and brighter as the sun came nearer, till at length his first rays all at once alighted on the top of a rock before her, like some golden creature fresh from the sky. Then she saw that the little stream ran out of a hole in that rock, and that the path did not go past the rock, and that the thread was leading her straight up to it. A shudder ran through her from head to foot when she found that the thread was actually taking her into the hole out of which the stream ran. It ran out babbling joyously, but she had to go in. She did not hesitate. Right into the hole she went, which was high enough to let her walk without stooping. For a little way, there was a brown glimmer, but at the first turn it all but ceased, and before she had gone many paces she was in total darkness. Then she began to be frightened indeed. Every moment she kept feeling the thread backwards and forwards. And as she went further and further into the darkness of the great hollow mountain, she kept thinking more and more about her grandmother, and all that she had said to her, and how kind she had been, and how beautiful she was, and all about her lovely room, and the fire of roses, and the great lamp that sent its light through stone walls. And she became more and more sure that the thread could not have gone there of itself, and that her grandmother must have sent it. But it tried her dreadfully when the path went down very steep, and especially when she came to places where she had to go down rough stairs and even sometimes a ladder. Through one narrow passage after another, over lumps of rock and sand and clay, the thread guided her, until she came to a small hole through which she had to creep. Finding no change on the other side, "Shall I ever get back?" she thought, over and over again, wondering at herself that she was not 10 times more frightened, and often feeling as if she were only walking in the story of a dream. Sometimes she heard the noise of water, a dull gurgling inside the rock. By and by she heard the sounds of blows, which came nearer and nearer. But again they grew duller and almost died away. In 100 directions she turned, obedient to the guiding thread. At last, she spied a dull red shine and came up to the mica window, and thence away and round about and right into a cavern where glowed the red embers of a fire. Here the thread began to rise. It rose as high as her head and higher still. What should she do? She lost her hold. She was pulling it down. She might break it. She could see it far up, glowing as red as her fire opal in the light of the embers. But presently she came to a huge heap of stones, piled in a slope against the wall of the cavern. On these she climbed, and soon recovered the level of the thread, only, however, to find, the next moment, that it vanished through the heap of stones and left her standing on it with her face to the solid rock. For one terrible moment she felt as if her grandmother had forsaken her. The thread which the spiders had spun far over the seas, which her grandmother had sat in the moonlight and spun again for her, which she had tempered in the rose fire and tied to her opal ring, had left her, had gone where she could no longer follow it, had brought her into a horrible cavern, and there left her. She was forsaken indeed. "When shall I wake?" she said to herself in agony. But the same moment knew that it was no dream. She threw herself upon the heap and began to cry. It was well she did not know what creatures, one of them with stone shoes on their feet, were lying in the next cave. But neither did she know who was on the other side of the slab. At length, the thought struck her that at least she could follow the thread backwards and thus get out of the mountain and home. She rose at once and found the thread. But the instant she tried to feel it backwards, it vanished from her touch. Forwards, it led her hand up to the heap of stones. Backwards, it seemed nowhere. Neither could she see it as before in the light of the fire. She burst into a wailing cry and again threw herself down on the stones. Chapter 21. The Escape. As the princess lay and sobbed, she kept feeling the thread mechanically, following it with her finger many times up the stones in which it disappeared. By and by, she began, still mechanically, to poke her finger in after it, between the stones as far as she could. All at once it came into her head that she might remove some of the stones and see where the thread went next. Almost laughing at herself for having never thought of this before, she jumped to her feet. Her fear vanished. Once more she was certain her grandmother's thread could not have brought her there, just to leave her there. And she began to throw away the stones from the top as fast as she could. Sometimes two or three at a handful, sometimes taking both hands to lift one. After clearing them away a little, she found that the thread returned and went straight downwards. Hence, as the heap sloped a good deal, growing of course wider towards its base, she had to throw away a multitude of stones to follow the thread. But this was not all, for she soon found that the thread, after going straight down for a little way, turned first sideways in one direction, then sideways in another, and then shot, at various angles, hither and thither inside the heap, so that she began to be afraid that to clear the thread she must remove the whole huge gathering. She was dismayed at the very idea, but losing no time, set to work with a will, and with aching back and bleeding fingers and hands, she went on, sustained by the pleasure of seeing the heap slowly diminish and begin to show itself on the opposite side of the fire. Another thing which helped to keep up her courage was that, as often as she uncovered a turn of the thread, instead of lying loose upon the stone, it tightened up. This made her sure that her grandmother was at the end of it somewhere. She had got about halfway down when she started and nearly fell with fright. Close to her ears, as it seemed, a voice broke out singing, "Jabber, bother, smash. You'll have it all in a crash. Jabber, smash, bother. You'll have the worst of the pother. Smash, bother, jabber. Here, Curdie stopped, either because he could not find a rhyme to jabber, or because he remembered what he had forgotten when he woke up at the sound of Irene's labours, that his plan was to make the goblins think he was getting weak. But he had uttered enough to let Irene know who he was. "It's Curdie," she cried joyfully. "Hush," came Curdie's voice again from somewhere. "Speak softly." "Why, you were singing loud," said Irene. "Yes, but they know I'm here, and they don't know you are. Who are you?" "I'm Irene," answered the princess. "I know who you are quite well. You're Curdie." "Why, however did you come here, Irene?" "My great-great-grandmother sent me, and I think I've found out why." "You can't get out, I suppose." "No, I can't." "What are you doing?" "Clearing away a huge heap of stones." "There's a princess," exclaimed Curdie, in a tone of delight, but still speaking in little more than a whisper. "I can't think how you got here, though." "My grandmother sent me after her thread." "I don't know what you mean," said Curdie. "But so, you're there. It doesn't much matter." "Oh, yes, it does," returned Irene. "I should never have been here but for her." "You can tell me all about it when we get out, then. There's no time to lose now," said Curdie. And Irene went to work, as fresh as when she began. "There's such a lot of stones," she said. "It will take me a long time to get them all away." "How far have you got?" asked Curdie. "I've got about the half away, but the other half is ever so much bigger." "I don't think you will have to move the other half. Do you see a slab laid up against the wall?" Irene looked and felt about with her hands, and soon perceived the outlines of the slab. "Yes," she answered, "I do." "Then I think," rejoined Curdie, "when you've cleared the slab about halfway down, or a bit more, I shall be able to push it over." "I must follow my thread," returned Irene, "whatever I do." "What do you mean?" exclaimed Curdie. "You will see when you get out," answered the princess, and went on harder than ever. But she was soon satisfied that what Curdie wanted done and what the thread wanted done were one and the same thing, for she not only saw that by following the turns of the thread, she had been clearing the face of the slab, but that, a little more than halfway down, the thread went through the crack between the slab and the wall into the place where Curdie was confined, so that she could not follow it any further until the slab was out of her way. As soon as she found this, she said in a right joyous whisper, "Now, Curdie, I think if you were to give a great push, the slab would tumble over." "Stand quite clear of it, then," said Curdie, "and let me know when you're ready." Irene got off the heap and stood on one side of it. "Now, Curdie," she cried. Curdie gave a great rush with his shoulder against it. Out tumbled the slab on the heap, and out crept Curdie over the top of it. "You've saved my life, Irene," he whispered. "Oh, Curdie, I'm so glad. Let's get out of this horrid place as fast as we can." "That's easier said than done," returned he. "Oh no, it's quite easy," said Irene. "We have only to follow my thread. I'm sure that it's going to take us out now." She had already begun to follow it over the fallen slab into the hole, while Curdie was searching the floor of the cavern for his pickaxe. "Here it is," he cried. "No, it is not," he added in a disappointed tone. "What can it be, then?" "I declare it's a torch. That is jolly." "It's better almost than my pickaxe. Much better if it weren't for those stone shoes," he went on, as he lighted the torch by blowing the last embers of the expiring fire. When he looked up, with the lighted torch casting a glare into the great darkness of the huge cavern, he caught sight of Irene disappearing in the hole out of which he had himself just come. "Where are you going there?" he cried. "That's not the way out. That's where I couldn't get out." "I know that," whispered Irene, "but this is the way my thread goes, and I must follow it." "What nonsense the child talks," said Curdie to himself. "I must follow her, though, and see that she comes to no harm. She will soon find she can't get out that way, and then she will come with me." So he crept over the slab once more into the hole with his torch in his hand. But when he looked about in it, he could see her nowhere. And now he discovered that although the hole was narrow, it was much longer than he had supposed. For in one direction the roof came down very low, and the hole went off in a narrow passage of which he could not see the end. The princess must have crept in there. He got on his knees in one hand, holding the torch with the other, and crept after her. The hole twisted about, in some places so low that he could hardly get through, in others so high that he could not see the roof. But everywhere it was narrow, far too narrow for a goblin to get through, and so I presume they never thought that Curdy might. He was beginning to feel very uncomfortable lest something should have befallen the princess, when he heard her voice almost close to his ear, whispering, "Aren't you coming, Curdy?" And when he turned the next corner, there she stood, waiting for him. "I knew you couldn't go wrong in that narrow hole, but now you must keep by me, for here is a great wide place," she said. "I can't understand it," said Curdy, half to himself, half to Irene. "Never mind," she returned. "Wait till we get out." Curdy, utterly astonished that she had already got so far, and by a path he had known nothing of, thought it better to let her do as she pleased. "At all events," he said again to himself, "I know nothing about the way, minor as I am, and she seems to think she does know something about it, though how she should passes my comprehension. So she's just as likely to find her way as I am, and as she insists on taking the lead, I must follow. We can't be much worse off than we are now." Reasoning thus, he followed her a few steps and came out in another great cavern, across which Irene walked in a straight line, as confidently as if she knew every step of the way. Curdy went on after her, flashing his torch about and trying to see something of what lay around them. Suddenly, he started back a pace as the light fell upon something close by, which Irene was passing. It was a platform of rock raised a few feet from the floor and covered with sheepskins, upon which lay two horrible figures asleep, at once recognized by Curdy as the king and queen of the goblins. He lowered his torch instantly, lest the light should awake them. As he did so, it flashed upon his pickaxe, lying by the side of the queen, whose hand lay close by the handle of it. "Stop one moment," he whispered. "Hold my torch, and don't let the light on their faces." Irene shuddered when she saw the frightful creatures, whom she had passed without observing them. But she did as he requested, and turning her back, held the torch low in front of her. Curdy drew his pickaxe carefully away, and as he did so, spied one of her feet projecting from under the skins. The great, clumsy granite shoe, exposed thus to his hand, was a temptation not to be resisted. He laid hold of it, and with cautious efforts drew it off. The moment he succeeded, he saw to his astonishment that what he had sung in ignorance to annoy the queen was actually true. She had six horrible toes. Overjoyed at his success, and seeing by the huge bump in the sheepskins where the other foot was, he proceeded to lift them gently. For, if he could only succeed in carrying away the other shoe as well, he would be no more afraid of the goblins than of so many flies. But, as he pulled at the second shoe, the queen gave a growl and sat up in bed. The same instant the king awoke also and sat up beside her. "Run, Irene," cried Curdy, for though he was not now in the least afraid for himself, he was for the princess. Irene looked once round, saw the fearful creatures awake, and like the wise princess she was, dashed the torch on the ground and extinguished it, crying out, "Here, Curdy, take my hand." He darted to her side, forgetting neither the queen's shoe nor his pickaxe, and caught hold of her hand as she sped fearlessly where her thread guided her. They heard the queen give a great bellow, but they had a good start, for it would be some time before they could get torches lighted to pursue them. Just as they thought they saw a gleam behind them, the thread brought them to a very narrow opening, through which Irene crept easily and Curdy with difficulty. "Now," said Curdy, "I think we shall be safe." "Of course we shall," returned Irene. "Why do you think so?" asked Curdy. "Because my grandmother is taking care of us." "That's all nonsense," said Curdy. "I don't know what you mean." "Then if you don't know what I mean, what right have you to call it nonsense?" asked the princess, a little offended. "I beg your pardon, Irene," said Curdy. "I did not mean to vex you." "Of course not," returned the princess. "But why do you think we shall be safe?" "Because the king and queen are far too stout to get through that hole." "There might be ways around," said the princess. "To be sure, there might. We are not out of it yet," acknowledged Curdy. But what do you mean by the king and queen? Asked the princess. I should never call such creatures as those a king and a queen. Their own people do, though, answered Curdy. The princess asked more questions, and Curdy, as they walked leisurely along, gave her a full account, not only of the character and habits of the goblins, so far as he knew them, but of his own adventures with them, beginning from the very night after that in which he had met her and Luti upon the mountain. When he had finished, he begged Irene to tell him how it was that she had come to his rescue. So Irene had to tell a long story, which she did in rather a roundabout manner, interrupted by many questions concerning things she had not explained. But her tale, as he did not believe more than half of it, left everything as unaccountable to him as before, and he was nearly as much perplexed as to what he must think of the princess. He could not believe that she was deliberately telling stories, and the only conclusion he could come to was that Luti had been playing the child tricks, inventing no end of lies to frighten her for her own purposes. But however did Luti come to let you go into the mountains alone? He asked. Luti knows nothing about it. I left her fast asleep. At least I think so. I hope my grandmother won't let her get in trouble, for it wasn't her fault at all, as my grandmother well knows. But how did you find your way to me? Persisted Curdy. I told you already, answered Irene, by keeping my finger upon my grandmother's thread, as I'm doing now. You don't mean you've got the thread there? Of course I do. I've told you so 10 times already. I have hardly, except when I was removing the stones, taken my finger off it. There, she added, guiding Curdy's hand to the thread. You feel it yourself, don't you? I feel nothing at all, replied Curdy. Then what can be the matter with your finger? I feel it perfectly. To be sure, it is very thin, and in the sunlight looks just like the thread of a spider, though there are many of them twisted together to make it. But for all that, I can't think why you shouldn't feel it as well as I do. Curdy was too polite to say he did not believe there was any thread there at all. What he did say was, well, I can make nothing of it. I can, though, and you must be glad of that, for it will do for both of us. We're not out yet, said Curdy. We soon shall be, returned Irene confidently. And now the thread went downwards and led Irene's hand to a hole in the floor of the cavern, whence came a sound of running water which they had been hearing for some time. It goes into the ground now, Curdy, she said, stopping. He had been listening to another sound, which his practiced ear had caught long ago, and which also had been growing louder. It was the noise the goblin miners made at their work, and they seemed to be at no great distance now. Irene heard it the moment she stopped. What is that noise? She asked. Do you know, Curdy? Yes, it is the goblins digging and burrowing, he answered. And you don't know what they do it for? No, I haven't the least idea. Would you like to see them? He asked, wishing to have another try after their secret. If my thread took me there, I shouldn't much mind, but I don't want to see them, and I can't leave my thread. It leads me down into the hole, and we better go at once. Very well. Shall I go in first? Said Curdy. No, better not. You can't feel the thread, she answered, stepping down through a narrow break in the floor of the cavern. Oh, she cried, I'm in the water. It is running strong, but it is not deep. And there's just room to walk. Make haste, Curdy. He tried, but the hole was too small for him to get in. Go on a little bit, he said, shouldering his pickaxe. In a few moments he had cleared a larger opening and followed her. They went on, down and down with the running water, Curdy getting more and more afraid it was leading them to some terrible gulf in the heart of the mountain. In one or two places he had to break away the rock to make room before even Irene could get through, at least without hurting herself. But at length they spied a glimmer of light, and in a minute more they were almost blinded by the full sunlight into which they emerged. It was some little time before the princess could see well enough to discover that they stood in her own garden, close by the seat on which she and her king papa had sat that afternoon. They had come out by the channel of the little stream. She danced and clapped her hands with delight. Now, Curdy, she said, won't you believe what I told you about my grandmother and her thread? for she had felt all the time that Curdie was not believing what she told him. "There, don't you see it shining on before us?" she added. "I don't see anything," persisted Curdie. "Then you must believe without seeing," said the princess, "for you can't deny it has brought us out of the mountain." "I can't deny we're out of the mountain, and I should be very ungrateful indeed to deny that you had brought me out of it." "I couldn't have done it but for the thread," persisted Irene. "That's the part I don't understand." "Well, come along, and Luti will get you something to eat. I'm sure you must want it very much." "Indeed I do. But my father and mother will be so anxious about me, I must make haste, first up the mountain to tell my mother, and then down into the mine again to let my father know." "Very well, Curdie, but you can't get along without coming this way, and I will take you through the house, for that is nearest." They met no one by the way, for indeed, as before, the people were here and there and everywhere, searching for the princess. When they got in, Irene found that the thread, as she had half expected, went up the old staircase, and a new thought struck her. She turned to Curdie and said, "My grandmother wants me. Do come up and see her. Then you will know that I've been telling you the truth. Do come, to please me, Curdie. I can't bear you should think what I say is not true." "I never doubted you believed what you said," returned Curdie. "I only thought you had some fancy in your head that was not correct. But do come, dear Curdie." The little miner could not withstand this appeal, and though he felt shy in what seemed to him a huge grand house, he yielded and followed her up the stair. Chapter 22. The Old Lady and Curdie. Up the stair then they went, and the next, and through the long rows of empty rooms, and up the little tower stair, Irene growing happier and happier as she ascended. There was no answer when she knocked at length at the door of the workroom, nor could she hear any sound of the spinning wheel, and once more her heart sank within her, but only for one moment as she turned and knocked at the other door. "Come in," answered the sweet voice of her grandmother, and Irene opened the door and entered, followed by Curdie. "You darling," cried the lady, who was seated by a fire of red roses mingled with white. "I've been waiting for you, and indeed getting a little anxious about you, and beginning to think whether I had better not go and fetch you myself." As she spoke, she took the little princess in her arms and placed her upon her lap. She was dressed in white now, and looking, if possible, more lovely than ever. "I've brought Curdie, grandmother. He won't believe what I've told him, and so I've brought him." "Yes, I see him. He's a good boy, Curdie, and a brave boy. Aren't you glad you've got him out?" "Yes, grandmother. But it wasn't very good of him not to believe me when I was telling him the truth." "People must believe what they can, and those who believe more must not be hard upon those who believe less. I doubt if you would have believed it all yourself if you hadn't seen some of it." "Ah, yes, grandmother, I dare say. I'm sure you're right. But he'll believe now." "I don't know that," replied her grandmother. "Won't you, Curdie?" said Irene, looking round at him as she asked the question. He was standing in the middle of the floor, staring and looking strangely bewildered. This, she thought, came out of his astonishment at the beauty of the lady. "Make a bow to my grandmother, Curdie," she said. "I don't see any grandmother," answered Curdie rather gruffly. "Don't you see my grandmother when I'm sitting in her lap?" exclaimed the princess. "No, I don't," reiterated Curdie in an offended tone. "Don't you see the lovely fire of roses, white ones amongst them this time?" asked Irene, almost as bewildered as he. "No, I don't," answered Curdie, almost sulkily. "Nor the blue bed, nor the rose-coloured counterpane, nor the beautiful light like the moon hanging from the roof?" "You're making game of me, Your Royal Highness. And after what we've come through together this day, I don't think it is kind of you," said Curdie, feeling much hurt. "Then what do you see?" asked Irene, who perceived at once that for her not to believe him was as bad as for him not to believe her. "I see a big bare garret room, like the one in Mother's cottage, only big enough to take the cottage itself in, and leave a good margin all round, answered Curdy. And what more do you see?
I see a tub, and a heap of musty straw, and a withered apple, and a ray of sunlight coming through a hole in the middle of the roof and shining on your head, and making all the place look a curious dusky brown.
I think you'd better drop it, princess, and go down to the nursery, like a good girl.
But don't you hear my grandmother talking to me? Asked Irene, almost crying.
No, I hear the cooing of a lot of pigeons.
If you don't come down, I will go without you. I think that it will be better anyhow, for I'm sure nobody who met us would believe a word we said to them. They would think we made it all up. I don't expect anybody but my own father and mother to believe me. They know I won't tell a story.
And yet you won't believe me, Curdy, expostulated the princess, now fairly crying with vexation and sorrow at the gulf between her and Curdy.
No, I can't, and I can't help it, said Curdy, turning to leave the room.
What shall I do, grandmother? Sobbed the princess, turning her face round upon the lady's bosom and shaking with suppressed sobs.
You must give him time, said her grandmother, and you must be content not to be believed for a while. It is very hard to bear, but I have had to bear it, and shall have to bear it many a time yet.
I will take care of what Curdy thinks of you in the end. You must let him go now.
You're not coming, are you? Asked Curdy.
No, Curdy. My grandmother says I must let you go.
Turn to the right when you get to the bottom of all the stairs, and that will take you to the hall where the great door is.
Oh, I don't doubt I can find my way without you, princess, or your old granny's thread either, said Curdy quite rudely.
Oh, Curdy, I wish I had gone home at once. I'm very much obliged to you, Irene, for getting me out of that hole, but I wish you hadn't made a fool of me afterwards. He said this as he opened the door, which he left open, and without another word went down the stair. Irene listened with dismay to his departing footsteps, then turning again to the lady.
What does it all mean, grandmother? She sobbed, and burst into fresh tears.
It means, my love, that I did not mean to show myself.
Curdy is not yet able to believe some things. Seeing is not believing. It is only seeing.
You remember I told you that if Luti were to see me, she would rub her eyes, forget the half she saw, and call the other half nonsense?
Yes, but I should have thought Curdy.
You're right. Curdy is much further on than Luti, and you will see what will come of it. But in the meantime, you must be content, I say, to be misunderstood for a while. We are all very anxious to be understood, and it is very hard not to be. But there is one thing much more necessary.
What is that, grandmother?
To understand other people.
Yes, grandmother, I must be fair, for if I'm not fair to other people, I'm not worth being understood myself.
I see.
So as Curdy can't help it, I will not be vexed with him. But just wait.
There's my own dear child, said her grandmother, and pressed her close to her bosom.
Why weren't you in your workroom when we came up, grandmother? Asked Irene, after a few moments' silence.
If I had been there, Curdy would have seen me well enough.
But why should I be there rather than in this beautiful room?
I thought you would be spinning.
I've nobody to spin for just at present. I never spin without knowing for whom I am spinning.
That reminds me. There is one thing that puzzles me, said the princess. How are you able to get the thread out of the mountain again? Surely you won't have to make another one for me. That would be so much trouble.
The lady set her down and rose and went to the fire. Putting in her hand, she drew it out again and held up the shining ball between her finger and thumb.
I've got it now, you see, she said, coming back to the princess. All ready for you when you want it. Going to her cabinet, she laid it in the same drawer as before.
And here is your ring, she added, taking it from the little finger of her left hand and putting it on the forefinger of Irene's right hand.
Oh, thank you, grandmother. I feel so safe now.
You're very tired, my child, the lady went on. Your hands are hurt with the stones, and I've counted 9 bruises on you. Just look what you're like. And she held up to her a little mirror, which she had brought from the cabinet. The princess burst into a merry laugh at the sight. She was so draggled with the stream and dirty with creeping through narrow places
that if she had seen the reflection without knowing it was a reflection, she would have taken herself for some child whose face was washed and hair combed about once in a month. The lady laughed too, and lifting her again upon her knee, took off her cloak and nightgown. Then she carried her to the side of the room. Irene wondered what she was going to do with her, but asked no questions, only starting a little when she found that she was going to lay her in the large silver bath. For she looked into it, again she saw no bottom, but the stars shining miles away, as it seemed, in a great blue gulf. Her hands closed involuntarily on the beautiful arms that held her, and that was all. The lady pressed her once more to her bosom, saying, "Do not be afraid, my child." "No, grandmother," answered the princess, with a little gasp. And the next instant she sank in the clear, cool water. When she opened her eyes, she saw nothing but a strange, lovely blue over and beneath and all about her. The lady in the beautiful room had vanished from her sight, and she seemed utterly alone. But instead of being afraid, she felt more than happy, perfectly blissful. And from somewhere came the voice of the lady singing a strange, sweet song, of which she could distinguish every word. But of the scent, she had only a feeling, no understanding. Nor could she remember a single line after it was gone. It vanished like the poetry in a dream, as fast as it came. In after years, however, she would sometimes fancy that snatches of melody suddenly rising in her brain must be little phrases and fragments of the air of that song. And the very fancy would make her happier and enable her to do her duty. How long she lay in the water, she did not know. It seemed a long time, not from weariness, but from pleasure. But at last she felt the beautiful hands lay hold of her, and through the gurgling water she was lifted out into the lovely room. The lady carried her to the fire and sat down with her in her lap and dried her tenderly with the softest towel. It was so different from Luti's drying. When the lady had done, she stooped to the fire and drew from it her nightgown as white as snow. "How delicious," exclaimed the princess. "It smells of all the roses in the world, I think." When she stood up on the floor, she felt as if she had been made over again. Every bruise and all the weariness were gone, and her hands were soft and whole as ever. "Now I'm going to put you to bed for a good sleep," said her grandmother. "But what will Luti be thinking? And what am I to say to her when she asks me where I've been?" "Don't trouble yourself about it. You will find it all come right," said her grandmother, and laid her into the blue bed under the rosy counterpane. "There's just one thing more," said Irene. "I'm a little anxious about Curdie. As I brought him into the house, I ought to have seen him safe on his way home." "I took care of all that," answered the lady. "I told you to let him go, and therefore I was bound to look after him. Nobody saw him, and he is now eating a good dinner in his mother's cottage far up in the mountain." "Then I will go to sleep," said Irene. And in a few minutes, she was fast asleep. Good night.